Hey everyone, I'm Michael Whistler, and I sincerely believe that science fiction can help us save the world. This week, we are going to talk about Midnight Sky, the George Clooney-directed Netflix original movie that just hit Netflix last week, right before Christmas. So strap in and get ready for some space nerd critique and some story analysis. And some questions around the meaningfulness of this particular story. This is Exploring Tomorrow. If you've been checking out the podcast at all, you may have noticed that a lot of times I try to have discussions about particular books and movies in a way that doesn't reveal too many plot spoilers. This is going to be a bit of an exception today. So if you have not seen Midnight Sky and you don't want any spoilers, then I recommend you pause now and go check it out. And that's one spoiler I will give you as far as this podcast is concerned, is that I do actually recommend you pause now and go watch Midnight Sky. And then you can come back and check out the rest of the episode and not feel concerned about me giving away any of the plot points and the character development and all those kinds of things so that you can go experience that first. I always recommend that, especially because you can come to this discussion with your own perspective, which is always a better place to come from with actual experience and perspective. So having said that, if you need to, pause now, go check it out. I'll wait for you. Wow, that was fast. Good job. Yeah, nice. Anyway, we'll carry on for the rest of us. So, Midnight Sky. When I saw that Clooney was releasing this new movie through Netflix, I was definitely excited. I've always had a kind of an interest in Clooney's directorial career because I was just really impressed with his first directorial effort, which is Good Night and Good Luck, a historical drama about Edward R. Murrow confronting Joseph McCarthy during, you know, the sort of McCarthy era of really what honestly can only be called a witch hunt during what we now refer to as McCarthyism, right? The whole Red Scare. We got to weed out the communists from among us. Well, beautiful movie, not sci-fi at all. Still a very worthwhile movie if you've never seen it. And I've always been sort of interested in what Clooney's kind of doing after that. I would say he's had some missteps along the way. His other efforts as a director haven't always panned out and been really sure-footed films with quite the level of maturity and execution as Good Night and Good Luck. It's a hard movie to top, honestly. It's really amongst, I think, some of the best cinema I've ever seen. And still, you know, that also means that I have high hopes in some ways for Clooney, having done that kind of work in the past. And it may just be that he, being the son of a journalist and really having considered journalism extensively himself, he's really close to the story in Good Night and Good Luck, and he does a great job of telling that story coming from that place. That maybe is why that there's some magic happening in that particular movie that doesn't seem to quite come through in his other films. Even though I have enjoyed his other films in their own right. A lot of people really panned The Monuments Men, but I thought it was okay. Well, here we are with a new George Clooney effort, and it's sci-fi, which is cool. Now, for a little context, too, you know, it's, I think it's important and worthy of noting that Clooney has acted in both the Soderbergh remake of Solaris, and he was in Gravity, two sort of big notable space sci-fi movies that he was in. So I think he's coming with at it with a bit of sort of that actor familiarity of that territory. Of note, in this movie, he is not in space at all himself. All the other characters are, right? He's almost, it almost feels like he's on a his own sort of isolated planet, right? Being in Antarctica. And in many ways, he is on his own isolated planet, given what we slowly learn about what's taking place. But yeah, I think it's worth bringing up that background for Clooney because I think he has some awareness of the genre and sort of the tropes in the execution necessary. There's a lot of things about this film that feel similar to Solaris. And to be fair, Soderbergh's effort on the remake of Solaris is a very watchable and enjoyable film in its own right. I'm a little partial to the original Tartakovsky film, Andrei Tartakovsky, Russian director. I personally really enjoyed that movie, that version of it. These are slow-paced, deliberate, very introspective movies. They're sort of precursor. Tarkovsky is definitely a precursor to say, Terrence Malick, who tends to direct these very sort of slow-paced, methodical, really introspective, character-driven stories. And I think that kind of background and context is helpful when approaching The Midnight Sky. Because right off the bat, one of the things I noticed about the film is it starts very much in the vein of those kinds of films that are deliberately paced and that you really need to carefully pay attention to and really be glued to the screen and kind of allow yourself to enter this sort of meditative state to soak it in. It's not an action movie, and it's not going to be about fast cutting and moving all over the place and a lot of like crazy big explosions or anything like that. It's sort of the polar opposite of a Michael Bay movie, is I think a good way of putting it. And I noticed that right off the bat, given how it was starting. I also noticed that it started to give us hints very early on, like right away, as to the type of movie is going to be, in the sense of you're going to have to do a little bit of work. It's not going to be spoon-fed to you. We're not just going to like quickly info dump a bunch of backstory, exposition, so that you can know exactly what's happening. You know, we just get a, you know, quick little indicator of location and date, and it's 3 weeks after the event. And we don't really get, you know, to know for quite a while what the event is. But that to me was a clue right there. I was like, okay, I'm gonna have to pay attention and really be clued in to what's going on, because this isn't gonna be sort of spoon-fed to me. There's a certain level of putting the puzzle together. It's basically inviting audience participation. And I love that kind of movie myself. I really do. And so I was like, great, high expectations. Let's see where this goes. Now, overall, my reaction to the film is that it is a worthwhile watch with some definite flaws. So I would land at, I think, around a 7 for this movie out of 10. I think that's what I rated it on IMDb. So I definitely liked it, didn't love it, wanted to love it, didn't love it, couldn't love it. I think, unfortunately, once again, there's some missed opportunities here within the story and the pacing of the story and the unfolding of it. I don't mind the slow pacing. I like the slow pacing, actually, as I've sort of indicated. I know for a lot of people that's like, oh man, like what am I watching? And to be fair, it is the kind of movie that you really do need to sit down and soak in and absorb. You can't watch this movie like this. I'm sorry, you just can't. And, you know, I kind of gave my wife a hard time for that one, because there was one point in the movie when they're out trying to traverse the Antarctic plains, right? All the snow, and they're in the middle of that windstorm. And quickly, you know, this shape of a wolf, Arctic wolf, comes by in the foreground, and I'm like, oh, and my wife looks up from her phone and says, oh, what? And I'm like, this is not that kind of movie. You got to put the phone down. You're going to miss that kind of, those kind of details, because Clooney is, if nothing else, is definitely a visual storyteller, and he's utilizing all those elements to tell the story. Whereas, you know, the temptation might be for so many other directors to put in a wolf howl there to make sure, just, you know, in case people are not paying attention sharp enough to get it, they're going to see, they won't see it. They'll hear it. But it's like, let's be honest. If a wolf's on the prowl, is it howling to let its prey know, like, by the way, I'm going to eat you? No. Anyway, I give my wife a little hard time for that. Poor gal. That's because I'm, you know, cinema nerd. But I'm guilty of, you know, sometimes looking at my phone too. So I get it. And all of that just to say, this is not that kind of movie. This is not something that you can really kind of half watch. You have to fully watch it. Because we don't get the, like, explicit details spelled out for us about what happened. I mean, I know that I even had a conversation later on in the movie with my wife about, oh, what's going on? And I was like, oh yeah, you know, and part of it's just maybe based on my extensive reading in science fiction and being so familiar, especially with science fiction that was born out of the Cold War. This fits right into that world of fiction born out of the Cold War, around all the fears of nuclear proliferation. And so it was very clear to me, at least, what was going on when we started seeing the maps and seeing the spreading red circles. Very obvious to me that, okay, we're talking about a worldwide nuclear deployment that is an extinction level event for humanity. The radiation, you know, if the explosion doesn't get you, the radiation will. And frankly, as far as the survival of the human race, that's the thing that we're really concerned about. Most people won't die from direct hits and the detonation of nuclear weapons. It will be the intense radiation falling out after that, and all of the impact that it has on the atmosphere and the ability for plants and animals to continue living. That would really spell the doom for the human race, and really for all of Earth, most likely. I mean, aside from, like, what, cockroaches, right? And probably some deep sea animals that maybe can be far enough away from the radiation, and whose food source wouldn't be directly affected by the radiation as well. But anything that's eating something else that has ventured up towards the surface and been exposed to radiation is probably also going to eventually succumb to radiation poisoning. And we see that also play out in the movie later. The man that Clooney's character finds in the airplane, it's clear radiation poisoning, radiation burns, and he's really not in a good state. His organs are going to be failing in that scenario, which is why it's ultimately a kindness, right, that Clooney does for that guy to ultimately kill him, take him out of his misery, because there's no way he can save him. And frankly, at that point, he's probably been so exposed to radiation and so frostbitten that, you know, it's really just a matter of time. So, you know, I get it. Why don't I love this movie? Because there's a lot of things I like about it. I like this type of storytelling. I like how it's paced. I like the subject matter. I appreciate the theme of, is humanity worth saving, and what can we do, and what do we, who do we become in the face of these like really catastrophic events? What choices do we make? And ultimately, let's face it, it's a movie actually about fatherhood. Is really at the heart of what this film is about, is actually about fatherhood and the choice to be or not be a father. And now I'm a sucker for these stories because I'm a father. And having a 7-year-old daughter who is just my whole world, who's just, you know, a really such a huge part of who I am at this point and what I am living life for. I have a soft spot for stories that are about fatherhood. So all of those things really resonate with me and really connect with me. And that's why I want to love the movie. And now, why can't I love the movie? Well, part of it is execution. I'm a space nerd. And I can't help but notice some things, especially being a space nerd who writes science fiction and researches it and studies it, both science fiction and science and actual space exploration and what it would take. Big fan of hard sci-fi, you know, stuff like Saturn Run that really gets it right, what it would take to do a journey out to, you know, one of our neighboring planets, which is part of the storyline in this particular movie. And by the way, just a worthy disclaimer, I have not read the book this is based on. The movie Midnight Sky is based on a book, but it's not one that I've read. I am curious to check it out now because I like making that comparison. At the same time, I think it's always worthwhile to be able to approach a movie on its own terms and not always compare it to something it might be based on, because any adaptation should be able to stand on its own and should, you know, be worthy of its own merits if it's a good execution. So I have nothing really to say in this particular episode about how the movie compares to the book because I have not read the book. So I don't know for sure how all the space exploration details and science play out in the book compared to the movie, if that was just some Hollywoodization at points. But some key factors that I think really are a bit challenging to me is the discovery of this new moon that's essentially a planet. It seems a bit like, ooh, really? We haven't noticed? Like, we've been staring pretty hard at our neighboring planets for quite a while. I mean, I guess it's like maybe feasible in to some degree, but I mean, what are the chances? But that one's like, I was willing, it's early enough in the story and it's, you know, it's, I'm always willing, especially in sci-fi, to give an early hand-wavy pass, you know, a suspension of disbelief, like, because there's always some sort of plot point or some sort of device, some sort of what if at the beginning of a story, especially in science fiction, that we need to suspend disbelief on and say, okay, oh, well, what if this were the case, right? So I'm like, I have some questions about how that would play out. And as a sort of geeky writer myself, I that's the kind of stuff that I would be sitting around going, how do I explain the plausibility of this previously undiscovered but definitely habitable environment? You know, especially because it seems to apparently be a place that has a breathable atmosphere for human beings and vegetation, but we're not sure about animal life. I don't know. We don't really see animal life. Has any animal life evolved on this particular place? And some of the geological and astronomical factors that would play into how this planet would really, well, planet moon would really function, given that it's not exactly a planet as we know Earth, orbiting the sun in what we've come to call the Goldilocks zone, that gives us enough distance from the sun to allow us to get ample energy from the sun without getting cooked. And then what about its rotation and, you know, you get it. Anyway, I geek out about all this stuff. So I have a lot of questions about that, and the movie never really addresses or answers it. And to be fair, the movie doesn't answer those things because that's not ultimately what the movie is about. It's a little bit like, you know, people complained about like the movie Signs, you know, like, oh, what the aliens, there's more questions about the aliens and blah, blah, blah. And I'm like, yeah, I get it. But when you really get down to it, that movie is not about aliens. That movie is about a guy who lost his faith. So, you know, we, as a storyteller, you always have to pick, especially when you're dealing with a compressed format, like a movie that it's, you know, only an hour and a half to maybe 2 hours long, maybe 3 hours, but still that format is closer to short stories than it is to novels, and you don't have the space to sort of dive into all of the sort of world building that sci-fi novels have the luxury of doing. So sometimes you got to go, my story is really about this, not that. So this story is really about fatherhood and sort of the continuation of the human species, sort of finding hope in the face of death, finding meaning in the face of extinction, and as such, figuring out exactly how this far-off moon is habitable, and that doesn't become sort of the focus of the story, which I can't fault it for. What I do struggle with as a space nerd are the debris fields that the spaceship ends up going through. The spaceship Ether, you know, I think they do a good job of creating what looks like a relatively plausible deep space spaceship. You know, it's, they don't make the mistakes of many other sci-fi movies in the past of like, they designed this like sleek aerodynamic thing. It's like, there's no air in space. it would not be aerodynamic. There's absolutely no need for it. What they do need is a big ass engine on the back of that thing that's gonna get them going very fast to be able to cover literally astronomical distances. And they need an ability to retain power, grow food, protect themselves, and generate some gravity artificially. Now, one thing I will give them in this movie is that they do the rotation, centrifugal force, as a means to create artificial gravity. That's a well-established actual way of being able to do it. Don't believe me? Just go grab a bucket of water, you know, just fill it like half full, and then get it swinging really good over your head. That's all they're doing on that spaceship. You know, they're just, so just the same way as the continual acceleration of the bucket by going in a circle is keeping the water at the bottom of the bucket, the same is happening inside the spaceship when they're, you know, at the either extreme of that system, that big spoke, you know, with the two sort of habitats at each end. So they get that. It's probably not big enough and fast enough to actually get 1G of gravity like on Earth. But, you know, we'll give it to them. They get it. And they don't make any stupid mistakes like What was that? There was another Netflix original movie, the Cloverfield Paradox, where they made a really stupid mistake there, where the space stations like got different parts that are rotating, and they're rotating past each other. And then when they have scenes like inside rooms of the space station, it's clear that they're rotating sideways. And it's like, that's not how centripetal force works. In that case, you would be walking on the wall. In the floor that you're standing on would actually be a wall to you. So they didn't get it right. That's an aside. Again, geeking out pretty hard on the science here a little bit. Hope that's all right with you. If you hate science, well, first, if you hate science, why are you listening to a science fiction podcast? But if you really hate this stuff, you can skip forward. It's fine. I'm going to geek out a little bit more because I kind of love it. And so I'll give them points for that. They did do that better than some other movies. The issue is when you're moving through space, you know, you're literally moving at astronomical speeds, thousands and thousands of miles per hour, to put it in numbers that we can sort of wrap our heads around. What happens is, even with a very robust spaceship, if you really are going to come into direct contact with an object out there in space, the chances are both of you are moving very fast. I mean, extremely fast. And this is like, we're talking about speeds that make bullets look like snails. So we're talking about the amount of kinetic force of an impact like that, that can just be utterly devastating. And a pea-sized rock could do insane damage. And this is one of the major problems that we have to confront and deal with when thinking about deep space travel. And so the fact that they go through these debris fields and they just like have these what feel very Earth-like interactions with stuff like bouncing off of the ship and breaking stuff and banging into things, but not just like bang and just like breaking the ship apart into pieces. No, it's not at all how any of that would play out. And so I got to give them a thumbs down on that part. None of that would actually work out that way. It would have to be an insanely rare instance of the relative speed of the spaceship and the relative speed of all that debris are so close, like super close, that they're only, you know, 100 miles per hour off from each other or something like that. So that you've got basically a rock flying at you at 100 miles an hour, and it can hit the side of your ship and break stuff, but not just like utterly obliterate your ship. Not likely to be the case. Most likely, things are moving at tens of thousands of miles per hour, and you're moving tens of thousands of miles per hour in a different direction. So relative to each other, you are both way faster than a speeding bullet. And boy, that's going to be a recipe for complete disaster. Yeah. And, you know, let's face it, for that kind of trip, that's the kind of speed they'd have to be going at. Now, the one thing that maybe we could say might be a factor is, well, the ship is nearly towards Earth, therefore it should be slowing down because it's, you know, coming in to make return to Earth possible. So it can't be moving along at the clip that it was for at least the first half of the trip. You know, in a scenario like this, you would have maybe like an ion engine that's, you know, slowly accelerating you for the entire time for the first half of the trip, and then you would turn around, point the your ion engine at Earth, and just let it start slowing you down for the second half of the trip. slow way to do it, but you can get, you make, you can cut the trip down significantly. But problem is, it doesn't seem to be how they do it. You know, front of the ship is front of the ship as we tend to think of it on Earth. And therefore, everything seems to be flying at it from that direction. They don't really seem to sort of address that aspect of it. And also, what debris is this that's so clumped together in space? Space is a pretty vast place. So this, unless this is a, I don't know, some asteroid that just recently broke up somehow, why is there all this debris out there? You know, we tend to do this in sci-fi movies and stuff, where we think about the asteroid belt. Oh yeah, you're going to fly through it like in Star Wars, and it's like, you got to and dodge all these asteroids. And that's just not what the asteroid belt is. There's like, you know, when we talk about distances between most of these asteroids, we're talking about astronomical units, you know, which is like the distance of the Earth to the sun. You know, we're again talking about hundreds of thousands to millions of miles between objects in space. So, you know, chances are you can actually travel places and not run into stuff like that. What you really got to watch out for is the pea-sized random thing that's hard to detect. The real, ironically, you know, for a movie that deals with radiation on Earth as a danger, it doesn't deal with that reality in space, which is actually the bigger danger, that the astronauts on the ship would be exposed to a major solar flare and major radiation headed their way. And therefore, they would have to actually hunker down in some radiation shelter for weeks. That's actually the bigger problem. Exposure, prolonged exposure in space leads to prolonged exposure to radiation. So again, one of the major problems with space travel that we have to figure out and overcome. Movie doesn't go there, doesn't deal with that at all. So I kind of dock it on these things because it's creating such a like beautifully plausible movie. This beautifully plausible scenario, and I'm just bummed that no one along the lines here said, this is a little too just Hollywood-y and not plausible enough. This isn't really how it will play out. I mean, they do some beautiful work in other places with the blood in zero G and how that, like, you know, floats everywhere and all that. Like, there's these things that they do that are so good that, and it's just a bummer that, yeah, but like the actual dangers of space that you encounter, they play out in, I think, just a really more glitzy, Hollywood-y kind of way that are just wholly implausible. And I got to dock the movie pretty hard for that. All right, so enough of me geeking out on sort of the science stuff. What about the plot and the story? Because I know I've seen the reactions from a lot of people, and they're like, why? What was the point of this movie? And I'm very frustrated with it. And I understand, you know what? It's one of those things where it's kind of like, it's my kind of movie in some ways. So I like it. However, I actually don't fault anyone for not liking it, because I really think it could have and should have been better executed. So I actually like the aspect of Clooney's character dealing with grief, with his own mortality, and really with the death of the entire human species, by really contending with his lost opportunity to be a father. And so I actually like, I'm totally cool with the, he's imagining, he's like had this like psychotic break, right? And he's basically talking to his imaginary 7-year-old daughter. Like, I'm cool with that. I did figure it out. You know, at some point, like, I think maybe halfway, 3/4 of the way through the movie, kind of had a sense like, yeah, this is his daughter. And as I started thinking about where that would correlate, you know, the suspicion started coming into mind there that, well, she's, his daughter may well be then on the ship, right? So who is that? Who's that going to be? So that part, it's like, it's a meaningful aspect of the story that I think is good. It was a little predictable in that capacity, maybe from my standpoint. But I still appreciate it. I don't know how I would go about doing it differently, but I do like that aspect of it overall, even though I kind of figured it out as I was going. And that's really what the movie ultimately is driving towards. It's a tricky thing to do, though, and it's gonna land for some people, and it's not gonna land for others. And just looking through reviews on IMDb, I can see like it really didn't land for some people. And then for other people are giving it like nines and tens, and they're like, this is like such an emotionally impactful film. And so it landed for them. It worked. And I think that's just the nature of this kind of storytelling. You take a risk, you try to do something like that, and it works for some people and it doesn't work for other people. So I completely get it at that. It's just, there are some people that are going to be like, why, what in the hell just happened? What did I watch? You know? And especially if you're looking for wanting answers on why was the whole world nuked and all that kind of stuff, then yeah, it's going to be disappointing. But again, I think we have to come back to, that's not what the movie is about. The movie is not an exploration of why the world nuked itself into oblivion and humans just sort of spelled their own doom. It's about the fallout and the aftermath of, do we save ourselves and can we save ourselves and what would that be like? And it's really about fatherhood in the face of, you know, when you really think about human existence and what life is all about, what choices will you make as a parent, right? And will you let your obsession govern the choices you make? Or will you be present to the people that need you the most? And so that kind of theme resonates heavily with me. And in that sense, this is a movie, this is a story that uses a sci-fi backdrop to tell a very human story. And it is not particularly... it's not particularly sci-fi in a lot of ways. I mean, you could, in some regards, strip away a lot of the sci-fi elements of it and still deal with it. And arguably, that already exists. It's called The Road by Cormac McCarthy. Also fascinating, bleak, post-apocalyptic movie. You know, it's a different way of doing it. They're telling similar stories about what lengths will you go to ensure the survival of your child and maybe some of the burdens and guilt around not having been the parent. In particular, in these two stories, the father. Maybe you should have and could have been. And what impact does that have on your psyche to a degree? And so all of those things, like, I appreciate that those are deep, worthwhile things to explore, and where it just doesn't end up working for me is that it's all lead up to this revelation at the end, but we don't get, we don't get quite the same level of satisfaction of maybe the full connection that the father and daughter maybe could have developed as they make, you know, the decision and the choice to sort of turn around and head back. And as he's still there, you know, basically facing death. I think there's a possibility there. Again, for a movie, it probably feels best to reach that sort of concluding moment and let it go, leave the rest of the imagination. But I think it is worth noting that the choices, the other two men on the ship make are related around relationship and people, and fatherhood, actually. They both have their own responsibilities as fathers to make the return, as it were. One is a surrogate father to his dead crewmate, dealing with his own grief of having lost his daughter. And the other as father who had left people, whole family behind to go on this mission, and promised that he would return to them. So again, the theme of fatherhood is, I think, really what this story comes down to. And even as we think about the fact that Felicity Jones's character is pregnant, so we're getting this aspect of parenting and the looking to the next generation and the responsibility and hope we have for that next generation. I think that that's really when I sort of reflected on the story, spent a few days sort of like bouncing around in my head after watching it. That's where I really came back to, was this is a story about parenting and our responsibility to the next generation. And there is, you know, certainly it's using the Cold War scenario of we nuke ourselves into oblivion as a very, because it would be a very immediate, you know, quick, drastic change to our planet that would spell our doom pretty quickly. I think as good science fiction, it's using that scenario to maybe give us a cautionary tale that has application in much broader realms, including climate change. That's just doing that potentially at a much slower rate. But there's still that question of what is our responsibility to the next generation, and how do we hand off to them a planet that is habitable and allows them to thrive and gives them the same opportunities that we were afforded. Now, one of the things that is a little problematic for me towards the end of the film is the choice to turn around and go back to this planet. Again, not a lot of thought seems to have been put into the actual science of all of this. And the gravity assist scenario of like, okay, we're going to approach Earth and we're going to, like, instead of going into an orbit, we're actually going to accelerate and like get a boost from the gravity of entering Earth's gravity well and being able to shoot ourselves back towards, was it K23, this moon? You know, that's legit. Yeah. The issues are, what about supply levels? I mean, I guess they are down 3 crew members. So what about supply levels? Secondly, what about the necessary supplies for a newborn baby? And ultimately, this was a mission of exploration, not a mission of colonization. So I don't know that they have the tools and the supplies and the training necessarily to go and colonize this place now and make it a permanent home for the human species. And part of the issue is that how is the human race going to survive on this planet without dealing with a heterozygosity, to borrow a term that I've recently picked up as I'm just about to finish Seven Eves, a really fascinating novel that's also dealing with this topic of the extinction of the human race. And one of the things they get into very heavily in that book is this idea of genetics and heterozygosity, and the fact that if you have all the same genes just being reproduced, you got this inbreeding problem, and it's not sustainable for the human species. So you have to get that, make sure it's a heterozygosity, basically, that you have a real big variety the genetic pool to pull from. And that's some of the big discussions that the characters are having in the story in order to ensure the survival of the human species in the face of a really catastrophic event. I will likely be discussing that book more at length when I finish it. So that's a teaser to that. But yeah, without any of that consideration, which, you know, even in like stuff like Interstellar, you get some thought around some of those things. So even, you know, this, I think it really does come down to, I guess they're going to go back to this planet and this moon, and they're going to live their lives there and raise their kid there, their daughter, right? And then they're going to kick it? I mean, like, it's like the human race is kind of done. Is the issue that I have there with that ending. Because unless they took a whole bunch of means to clone human beings there, I don't know how they're going to ensure future generations. Meanwhile, people hiding on Earth, you know, in deep underground bunkers may well ensure the survival of the human race in a far better means than they managed to by returning to K-23. The only question there would be, are they able to return to Earth at some point? At which point, really, like, how much fuel does this thing have and how much supplies do they have? It doesn't seem like a plausible scenario, so they would have been better off hanging out, orbiting Earth. All I have to say, I still found it to be an emotionally satisfying story, but I can't give it super high marks because there's all these aspects to it that pull me out of the story and go, yeah, that's not how that would work. And there's just, you know, I think even for a slow boil film, there are areas in which it could have been tightened up just a little bit more. And maybe a little more room made for some meaningful connection between Felicity Jones's character and George Clooney's character. It would have been really fascinating to see them sort of develop a little bit more of a relationship over the radio, even without her knowing that he's actually her father. I think that would have been a little more satisfying to me. So again, 7 out of 10. I still think it's a worthwhile watch if you're a sci-fi nerd, yeah, like me, if you like space movies. And now here's one of the things that I just want to close off with saying that, and one of the reasons why I also maybe have a soft spot for a movie like this. There aren't enough movies with thoughtful plots that are standalone, that are not parts of these big franchises, but that are doing science fiction for thinking adults. You know, there's just, I feel like there's just not enough of those. I want to watch more of those. And so even, you know, I have my issues with Interstellar, and yet I own the movie and have rewatched it and still find it like worthwhile in many regards, even though I ultimately have some issues with that story as well. But I appreciate that people like Christopher Nolan, that people like George Clooney are at least trying to make thoughtful adult science fiction, you know, in the vein of 2001 A Space Odyssey or Solaris and movies like that. That a movie like The Midnight Sky doesn't quite succeed in living up to masterpieces like Solaris or 2001 A Space Odyssey is unfortunate, but understandable. And I get it. And that's why I'm reticent to just throw it out and just be like, this is just complete trash. You know, I mean, if you want to talk about a sci-fi movie that ultimately I think is complete trash, I would say it's Passengers, because the plot is so ridiculously bungled and creepy and messed up. There's not much that redeems it there. And it's a bad plot with bad science on top of it. And kind of unbelievable characters. You know, so I'm hesitant to put Midnight Sky in the company of, say, Passengers, because, you know, that to me is a truly trash sci-fi movie. Or frankly, the Paradox or the Cloverfield Paradox or whatever that was a trash sci-fi movie as well. Whereas at least this is several degrees better than that. So all of that to say, still found it worthwhile, though I am a little disappointed. Would have liked to have been closing out the year here, singing the praises unreservedly to The Midnight Sky. But it's just not the case, and that's okay. But all of that, again, I come back to, hey, you know what? It's still a valiant effort, and there's still several things about it to there are still several things about it that I like, and as such, I find it a worthwhile watch, and I may even revisit it here at some point, and study some aspects of what doesn't work about the story as a storyteller to learn from them, to be like, okay, so why do I really feel like these don't work? What can I learn from them, and how do I avoid them in my own storytelling? That's, I think, always a worthwhile kind of study and investment as a storyteller as well. So that's my take on The Midnight Sky. A lot to unpack there. Ultimately, I still think it fits well within this world of meaningful science fiction because of its theme of parenthood and what are we handing off to the next generation. And what do we do? What sacrifices do we make to ensure the well-being, survival of the next generation? Which is everything that George Clooney's character is doing ultimately is driven really by his need to communicate with his daughter and let her know to not come back to Earth at this point. So all of that, I think, makes it fit well within that realm of meaningful science fiction. It's not perfectly executed, and that's just how it goes sometimes. Well, hey, thank you so much for listening to this episode. I hope you got a lot out of it, maybe at least some laughs at my utter nerdiness. I am so thankful for all of you that have been listening and commenting and giving feedback on the episodes and giving me suggestions for things to check out and to potentially talk about on the podcast. I'm wrapping up 2020 here. And in that sense, I'm wrapping up my sort of trial effort at this podcast. I wanted to give it through the end of the year and see how the podcast was received and what I was able to do with it. And I got to say, it's been awesome, a huge privilege, and I'm really loving the connections that I'm making. And I have so many other things that I want to explore yet. So I'm happy to say that I am looking forward to starting season 2 in January. And I've got a lot of cool stuff up my sleeve. I'm going to be bringing on some cool guests to talk about some fascinating topics. I'm going to get to dive into some of my favorites like Gattaca, maybe even talk about the Matrix sequels, talk about Blade Runner and Blade Runner 2049. Lots of cool stuff coming up. So please stay tuned. Please hit the subscribe button wherever you're getting this podcast from, whether it's on Spotify, Apple Podcasts, whether you're watching this on YouTube. Really appreciate it if you take the time to hit that subscribe button. And if you can leave a review, if you are on, say, Apple Podcasts, if you could leave an honest review, I really appreciate that as well, as that helps the podcast gain more exposure, get in front of more listeners that are interested in meaningful science fiction and exploring these big questions and geeking out about nerdy science stuff in sci-fi like this. Really appreciate it if you would do that. And if you happen to want to check out some of my own science fiction, please do so at michaelwhistler.com. I got a cyberpunk thriller that I most recently published called Sleepwalker that deals with human augmentation. Pretty fun, interesting topic in and of itself. Also have a sci-fi horror novel called Unidentified that deals with alien abduction. And I got some short stories on there as well if you feel like checking those out. Maybe a little easier way to dip your toes into the water and see what this crazy mind came up with. And looking forward to having a new novel out next year. More news about that coming soon. So stay tuned. Again, thank you for coming along for the ride, for listening and commenting. Please be safe and be well. I hope you have a happy, awesome new year. May 2021 just treat us all way better than 2020 did. And may we really just be able to continue being kind to each other and asking big questions. Thanks for coming along. We'll see you soon.